shared that in the 221 days of his papacy, people have been paying great attention to what he's been trying to communicate. Many, including longtime critics of the church, have been listening with interest and fascination. Many fallen away Catholics, thanks be to God, have in general been observing him likewise with wonder and have been reconsidering their practice in the church. The vast majority of practicing Catholics have been tuning in with a mixture of pride and wonder as he does things that popes are not accustomed to doing, from calling ordinary people on the phone, drinking mate given to him by just anonymous people in crowds in Rio, regularly departing from his written texts, and wondering what's going to happen next. Some Catholics are expressing concerns about the prudence of some of the ways he's choosing to communicate, typified in the interview that caught even his own press department off guard with Eugenio Scalfari of La Repubblica, when he allowed an 89-year-old man without a recording device or even a notebook to write out a lengthy interview all from memory, something that clearly opens the door to some imprecise phrases that could lead to confusion. And some in the much larger Catholic orbit, like the schismatic Bishop Bernard Fillet of the Society of St. Pius X, who said last week that the situation in the church is a real disaster and the present pope is making it 10,000 times worse, and used an epithet which is about the worst epithet that could come from the Society of St. Pius X, calling Pope Francis a modernist. So we've got a whole wide variety of impressions about the pope's communication, but no matter where one stands with regard to what Pope Francis is actually communicating, it's incontestable that he's clearly gotten everyone's attention. What I'd like to do in this talk is to break it down into two parts. The first, focusing on Pope Francis' communication style, and then second, his communication's substance, the how and the what. There are many lessons contained in both that we can ponder as Catholic disciples first, and as new media apostles second. And I'd like to take an apostolic dozen lessons from both the style and the substance. First lesson about Pope Francis' style is, as Monsignor Tai was saying above, should demonstrate the entire church's style, is he's authentic. There's no doubt that he's communicating what he really believes. He's not surrounded, like many leaders are, by a group of consultants and spinmeisters. He's not trial ballooning his expressions before focus groups. There seems, in some ways, no real communication strategy in a good sense. But sometimes there are consequences of that, as happened on July 5th, when he released a beautiful encyclical, his first, on the day it was totally drowned out by the announcement of the canonization of John Paul II and John the 23rd. And the biggest news story that day was when he was with Pope Benedict in the Vatican Guards blessing the statue of St. Michael. His encyclical, his teaching, was sort of drowned out by these other stories. If they had been done in a few consecutive days, we would have been able to have all of those messages. But he clearly prizes authenticity, and he's not spending a particular amount of time thinking about these types of things that communications departments would normally do. And this is part of what he's asking the entire church. On July 6th, he spoke to seminarians and novices and said, "To be joyful witnesses of the gospel, it's necessary to be authentic and consistent." And this is another word I want to say to you, he said, authenticity. Jesus severely reprimanded the hypocrites. Hypocrites who think, who within themselves, something other than what they say. Those who, to say it clearly, are two-faced. To speak of authenticity, especially to young people, costs nothing, because the young, all of them, have this wish to be authentic, to be consistent. And all of you are disgusted, strong term, disgusted, when you find in us priests that we are not authentic, or sisters who are not authentic. And he said a little bit later, talking about St. Francis of Assisi, proclaiming the gospel with an authentic life, with a consistent life, is so key. It's in our life that others first must be able to read the gospel. So first point about his style is he is who he is. He's totally authentic. Second, Monsignor Tai was mentioning upstairs, Pope Francis tries to show the faith, to give witness. For example, rather than talking about the dignity of every human being, he goes into the crowd and embraces at his inaugural mass a 50-year-old handicapped man or a little boy from Providence on Easter Sunday, showing the church's love for all that God has made. Rather than a homily on poverty, he embraces it with his own lifestyle. Rather than just preaching about the need to go to the peripheries, he goes to the peripheries himself. He enters Varginha in Brazil in order to visit some of the homes and go to the favelas there. He's witnessing his words. And he learns that, of course, from Jesus, who never said merely, "Do as I say, but follow me." When he spoke with the new movements on the vigil of Pentecost in St. Peter's Square, he said, "Faith can only be communicated through witness. And that means love. Not with our own ideas, but with the gospel lived out in our own lives and brought to life within us by the Holy Spirit." That's what he is trying to do. The day after he was elected, I was doing a hit on BBC International in the morning. I was there in Rome doing the color for EWTN, but we were able to do some other work, and pretty much every morning I was on with BBC. And the question the day after he was elected was, what do you think the symbolism is of Pope Francis's going to St. Mary Major the first day of his new papacy, going to pay his own bill, and going to the Sistine Chapel to celebrate the first Mass with the cardinals who elected him? And I asked, do I have the ability to be a brash American? And Louisa from BBC, with a little trepidation, said, "I think." And I said, there's a huge difference between the word symbol and sign. A symbol has no real intrinsic connection to what it's pointing to, like an octagonal sign in red with white letters saying STOP. Doesn't have any intrinsic connection to putting on your brakes. But a sign really has that natural connection, the connection between, for example, smoke and fire. I said, when Prime Minister Cameron or President Obama goes into a crowd to kiss babies, that's symbolism. When Pope Francis goes to St. Mary Major, when he goes to pay his own bill, that's a sign of what's really flowing from within. He's trying to live out what he's calling the whole church to live. Third point, he's available and personable. I thought it was significant in his September 19th interview with the Jesuit journals throughout the world that when he was asked by his fellow Jesuit who his model Jesuit was, he chose Blessed Peter Faber. And then when he was asked why, he gave what I think is an effective self-description. He said, "His dialogue with all, even the most remote, and even with his opponents." Peter Faber was a missionary in Germany right after the Protestant Reformation, and so it was very tough work. But he dialogued with all, even with his opponents. His simple piety, a certain naivete perhaps, his being available straight away, his careful interior discernment, the fact that he was a man capable of great and strong decisions, but also capable of being so gentle and loving. That strength as well as that gentleness. In some ways, he's a velvet hammer. He's very strong, but he's also tender at the same time. In Varginha, when he went to the favela, one of the poorest areas outside of Rio, he said beautifully, "I would like to knock on every door to say bon dia, to ask for a glass of cold water, to take a cafezinho, or as it's translated, a glass of grappa." He said cachaça, which was the local Portuguese word, the bathtub gin. "To speak as one would to family, friends, to listen to each person pouring out his or her heart, parents, children, grandparents." He has this personal connection, and it's something he really seeks. Fourth, he's unmediated and very direct. To the chagrin of, I think, some of his collaborators, he eliminates most middlemen, including the sala stampa, his own communications department, as we saw in the La Repubblica article. He eliminates middlemen in making his phone calls and has created some problems. There was a man in France who claimed that he had received a telephone call from Pope Francis in which Pope Francis basically said homosexuality is just fine, no problem with it. Turned out to be a prank from one of his friends. Just even this week, Pope Francis really did call this couple in Italy who had written him a letter because they've got a 17-month-old child who needs a lot of medical care. And this couple has been trying to get the Italian health ministry to pay for a special treatment. And she said that when Pope Francis spoke about that to her, he was in favor of the Italian health ministries paying for this treatment. And Father Lombardi, the papal press spokesman, basically had to say phone call happened, but Pope Francis' intention was not to take a stand on the decision of the Italian health ministry. So sometimes it creates some difficulties, but he's unmediated and very direct. Where do we see this most? We see it in his daily mass homilies, which I'm so happy drive the news. Every day at 7, I get on the Italian site of Vatican Radio to see what he said prior to my own 8 o'clock mass, and I'm happy to see most days it's up there right up at the top, because the most important thing the church ever does on any given day is this. When I was a newspaper executive editor for 7 years, I always had the dream that I never quite executed. One edition to have something like 80-point font saying, Jesus Christ come to the diocese on Sunday. Right? Because that's what happens. And that the fact that the Pope is making news by the single most significant thing he does every day is something we should take seriously, but it's another direct way in which he's able to form and communicate with people throughout the world. Fifth, we see that he's totally uninhibited. John Allen, a couple weeks back, wrote in one of his columns that a cardinal who knew him very well prior to his election told him in a private audience, "You're not the same guy I knew in Argentina." According to the cardinal, the Pope's reply was more or less the following. When I was elected, a great sense of inner peace and freedom came over me, and it's never left me. That was attested to by Monsignor Dario Viganò, who was the head of Vatican TV, describing the images of how crestfallen he was looking at the ground as he was leaving the Sistine Chapel immediately after his election. But then he sat in the back pew of the Pauline Chapel there before he would come out on the balcony, and after a few minutes he came on out and he was risen from the dead. When I was doing all my homework for the conclave, I watched a lot of YouTube videos of Cardinal Bergoglio from Argentina, and one of the things that I noted was what a lot of the folks in the Argentine press themselves had mentioned, that he didn't smile a lot. Now he's smiling all the time. He'd listen to his Argentinian Spanish and would basically be a pretty sedate three-note phrases, if you know musical notes. Now, in Italian, he's using 5 or 7 notes as he normally goes through. It's incredibly expressive. It's incredibly joyful. There's been a change. He's now uninhibited. And we see that probably most powerfully in the biggest change in his communication style since his election. He had said when he was flying over to Rio, when he came back to meet the press in the back of the plane, which they're generally charged $8,000 to $10,000 a seat, and the way their news departments pay for them to go aboard Shepherd One is because they'd always have an exclusive interview where the Pope would come back and answer a few of the questions from them. Pope Francis, when he was on that plane, said, "I'm here among the lions," but not particularly fierce ones. "Thank you. It's true that I don't give interviews, but why, I don't know. I can't." It's just like that. For me, it's quite an effort to do so. And then after the experience of World Youth Day, he gave a half-hour television interview with U Globo, an 80-minute interview on the plane, a lengthy interview with Jesuit journals, and then the interview with La Repubblica. Totally changed. He's now uninhibited and free. Sixth point about his style is he's simple in speech and in life. When he was in Rio speaking to the bishops on July 27th, he said, "One lesson that the church must constantly recall is that she can't leave simplicity behind. Otherwise, she forgets how to speak the language of mystery. She remains outside the door of that mystery. And she proves incapable of approaching those who look to the church for something that they themselves can't provide, namely God Himself. At times we lose people because they don't understand what we're saying, because we've forgotten the language of simplicity and import an intellectualism foreign to our people. Without the grammar of simplicity, the church loses the very conditions that make it possible to fish for God in the deep waters of His mystery." He was calling all bishops to that simplicity, and it's something that he again does by his example. Not just with his words, but by his body language. We all know famously of his simplicity in living in Buenos Aires, small little apartment, taking the bus and the metro. In Rome, he's moved into the Domus, Sancte Marte. He's downgraded his car, lives a very Spartan existence. When the editor of La Civiltà Cattolica visited him to do that interview for the Jesuit publications, he described his study: tiny desk, a few plain chairs, and only four objects in his entire room. An icon of St. Francis of Assisi, a statue of Our Lady of Lujan, the patroness of Argentina, an image of a sleeping St. Joseph, and those are the four, crucifix as well, if I didn't say that. Very simple. He's communicating a simplicity. And there are some serious words coming that he's going next year to be inviting the entire church to become poor in spirit, following the Lord, because our kingdom is really in heaven, as His is. Seventh, he's descriptive, especially in his use of unforgettable images. On the Chrism Mass on March 28th, he talked about a priest's anointing, and then with one of the Old Testament Psalms, how that's supposed to flow from the priest all the way down his beard, all the way out in his hands, through his words, so that the entire people likewise might be anointed, that the gospel has to be preached with unction, especially in the outskirts, where people of faith are most exposed to the onslaught of those who want to tear down their faith. A good priest, he says, is recognized by the way his people are anointed. Likewise, same homily he talked in one of his most famous images, that every pastor is supposed to have the smell of his sheep, the odor of those he's serving. He really has to draw close and get into their occasionally messy lives. "This I ask you, be shepherds," he said to the priests of the world, "with the odor of the sheep. Make it real as true shepherds of your flock." In the La Repubblica article, he talked about leprosy in the Vatican. Now, Monsignor Tai isn't a leper. He said that these are the sycophants that occasionally are found in any bureaucracy, the papal courtiers. He wants to change that, but the image is incredibly powerful. He talked about chicks and hens with clergy and seminarians. Jesus did this with his own disciples. He didn't keep them under his wing like a hen with her chicks. He sent them out. He's constantly using unforgettable images, I think, because of his powerful Jesuit lifetime of meditation on the incredibly memorable images of Jesus. Points to the graphic nature of his language. He's not just using simple phrases with images, but he's often being very blunt in his language in ways that snap us to attention. He said, "Many priests have faces like chilies pickled in vinegar, and they should never have it." He said, may our childlike heart know how to defend itself from the many windbags who make false promises. In Cagliari, to Superior General in May, he said, the consecrated woman is a mother. She must be a mother, not an old hag, not a spinster. Excuse me for speaking like this, he said, but motherhood in the consecrated life is important, this fruitfulness. On the plane interview coming back from Brazil, when he was talking about a priest working in the financial sector who had been arrested for trying to smuggle money illegally into the country, he said he didn't exactly go to prison because he was like Blessed Imelda Lambertini, the girl who died at the age of 11 receiving her first Holy Communion by going into ecstasy. That's why he wasn't thrown in the slammer, but because he wasn't behaving in that way. So don't water down your faith in Jesus Christ to his Argentinians who are there in Rio. We often dilute fruit drinks, orange, apple, and banana juice, but don't drink a diluted form of the faith. About the early charismatic movement, that many of them seem to confuse a liturgical celebration with samba lessons. Even in Assisi, a couple weeks back, when he was talking about how many mammoni there are in Italy, young men who never get married, and the pain for their mothers in keeping their kids at home well into their 30s and into their 40s. And he said, ma'am, stop ironing his shirts. And then in marital difficulties, the way he would do marital prep was tell couples about to be married, argue as much as you like. If the plates fly, let them. But never end the day without making peace. Never. Ninth part about his style is he's messy. I think he revels a little bit in making a mess. In the interview with Jesuit journals, he said, religious men and women are prophets. And obviously he's a Jesuit religious. A religious must never give up prophecy. Being prophets may sometimes imply making waves. I don't know how to put it. Prophecy makes noise, uproar, some say a mess. But in reality, the charism of religious people is like yeast. Prophecy announces the spirit of the gospel. He sees himself as someone capable of shaking things up in a good way. To younger Argentinians in Rio, he told them what his hope would be as they were returning home. I hope there will be noise. Here there will be noise. I want the noise to go out. May the bishops and priests forgive me if some of you create a bit of confusion afterward. But that's my advice, and thanks for whatever noise you can make. Likewise to the young people who had come to Rome from the Diocese of Piacenza Bobbio, he said, I wanted to tell you this and say to you, have courage, go forward and make a mess. When there are young people, there should be noise. Then things settle down, but the dream of a young person is to make noise forever. Go ahead. In life, there'll always be people who suggest that you slow down, who block your path. Go against the current. When you make noise, when you make a mess, sometimes there's going to be confusion, and we've seen it. But Pope Francis at the same time said at the Vigil of Pentecost in May, but what happens when we step outside of ourselves? The same as can happen in anyone who comes out of the house and onto the street. An accident! But I tell you, I far prefer a church that has a few accidents to a church that has fallen sick from being closed in on itself. Not everything's going to work, but he's boldly telling us to put out into the deep and take the risk. Tenth, he's tripartite in many of his communications with his famous three points. He explained to the catechists at the end of September who had come for the Year of Faith to Rome, I'm going to speak about three things. One, two, three. The way the old-fashioned Jesuits did. One, two, three. Not only is there a Trinitarian significance to three points, but also very easy to remember. As Monsignor Tai was telling us upstairs, very easy to pass on because we're able to remember. 11th, he's dialogical. He's showing how we're called not just to preach in a unidirectional way the faith, but how to enter into conversation. And we see that he uses questions a lot, especially when he wants to call people to conversion. He'll seldom make the declarative sentence, but he'll raise the question. On October 13th, he asked, "Am I a Christian by fits and starts, or am I a Christian full-time?" The Feast of St. Augustine, when he went over to the Church of St. Augustine, where his mom, St. Monica, is entombed, he said, "We may ask ourselves, am I anxious for God, anxious to proclaim Him, to make Him known? Or do I allow that spiritual worldliness to attract me that impels people to do everything for love of themselves?" I've got 10 different examples of that type of interrogation toward conversion, in which he's asking the question of himself and asking everybody else to enter into that conversation rather than saying they need to convert. He's trying to lead them to that conclusion on their own, which will be far more effective. Last part of his style in communication that I'd like to focus on is he's fatherly. More than anything else, he's trying to show the familial nature of the church. There's a certain maternal tenderness there too, but he's clearly fatherly. When he was speaking to the bishops of all the Latin American and Caribbean Episcopal conferences on July 28th in Rio, he said, "Bishops have to lead, but that's not the same thing as being authoritarian. I'd like to add a few things about the profile of a bishop. Bishops must be pastors, close to people, fathers and brothers, and gentle, patient, and merciful." And in the Jesuit Journal interview in September, he said, "The first reform that the church needs must be the attitude. The ministers of the gospel must be people who can warm the hearts of people, who walk through the dark night with them, who know how to dialogue and descend themselves into their people's night, into the darkness without getting lost. The people of God want pastors, not clergy acting like bureaucrats or government officials." And that's something that he's seeking to put into practice himself. It's 12 points on style. Let's turn to substance. As you've been following them, a lot of these points I think would be rather clear to you. There might be some debate about the 12, but I think that these are the 12 most significant messages that he's returning to over and over again. The first is he prioritizes preaching the kerygma, the real message that Christ has come into the world in order to save us. He says, other things come after that, but we have to make sure people get this fundamental big picture. In the Jesuit interview, he said, "I'm thinking about the preaching and content of our preaching. A beautiful homily, a genuine sermon must begin with the first proclamation of salvation. There's nothing more solid, deep, and sure than this proclamation. Then you have to do catechesis, helping people to understand the truths of the faith. And then you can draw even a moral consequence. But the proclamation of the saving love of God comes before moral and religious imperatives." In 2010, when he gave a book-length interview, El Jesuita, with Sergio Rubin, he talked about a degrading reductionism in the way the church proclaims the faith by often starting with what's perceived as moralism rather than beginning with Jesus Christ, His love, His will to save. Something that provokes astonishment, brings one to contemplation and faith. But if someone doesn't have that relationship with Jesus first, it's going to be very hard to talk about more controversial issues. As a priest, I never go up to somebody and say, "My name's Father Roger Landry. You're not on the pill, are you?" It's not generally going to be effective. But if their temperature can start to increase such that they are now warm with the love of God, it's then, by that faith, they can get the strength to pluck out eyes or chop off hands, if that's what it takes in order to continue to follow the Lord. But if you start with these types of operations, you're going to lose most people. He prioritized the kerygma. Second, he preaches mercy. This is such an incredible part of what he's trying to help us all amplify. Who is Jorge Mario Bergoglio? He was asked in that Jesuit interview. He said, I'm a sinner. This is the most accurate definition. It's not a figure of speech, a literary genre. I am a sinner, but I trust in the infinite mercy and patience of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's his message for the world. He was called in the very act of having his sins forgiven, September 21st, 1953, with an anonymous priest in his parish church of San Jose in Buenos Aires. In El Jesuit, to that book-length interview, when he said, whenever priests ask me for advice, I always respond, be merciful. In his interview on the plane, he said, I believe that this is a kairos, a special opportune time. This time is a kairos of mercy. And I'll never forget his first Sunday Angelus address. About 300,000 were in St. Peter's Square and the square of Pius XII at the top of the Via Conciliazione as he repeated what he had said in his Sunday Mass homily at the Church of Sant'Anna a few minutes before. Dio non si stanca mai di perdonare. God never tires of forgiving. It's we who tire of asking for it. Let us turn to the Lord and ask him for the grace never to tire of asking for what he never tires of giving. He wants the entire church to recognize that in the experience of receiving God's gratuitous merciful love, we ourselves are called. Miserando atque eligendo. And he says, if we don't grasp this, we miss the entire point of Christianity. In El Jesuita, he used an image which is unforgettable. He said, whenever there's a story told about a child, for example, falling into a river and somebody else diving off the bridge to save that child's life, everybody's watching this. But something changes when we recognize we were that child in that river and that Jesus Christ was the one who leapt from heaven and died pushing us to the shore. That's salvation. If we don't recognize what Jesus did for us, we're missing the whole point. As C.S. Lewis would say, two essential parts of the message. We're sinners, but Jesus came to save us from sin, to give us new life. Third point is that the church, Pope Francis and us, need to heal the world's wounds. I see clearly, he said, in the September 19th interview, that the thing the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and warm the hearts of the faithful. You have to heal wounds. Then we can talk about everything else. Heal the wounds. Heal the wounds. That the church is essentially meant to continue Jesus' work as the Good Samaritan. The church is ministers, and that means all of us through baptism and confirmation, not just the clergy. Church's ministers must be merciful to take responsibility for people and accompany them like the Good Samaritan, who washes, cleans, and raises up his neighbor. This is pure gospel, that God is greater than sin. As we heal the wounds, fourth message is that we've got to warm the hearts. That the whole new evangelization, as he described to the bishops in Rio, is to continue the Emmaus scene. Jesus entered into the journey of two men walking away from Jerusalem and everything Jerusalem symbolized. And Jesus didn't twist their arms and say, where the heck are you going? Turn around. What are you talking about? Entered into their conversation. Then brought the light of faith to their conversation in such a way that their hearts were burning. And after they recognized him in the breaking of the bread, even though they had walked 7 miles downhill as it was dusk, they ran 7 miles uphill during total darkness in order to spread the news that Jesus had truly risen. The whole church has got to enter into the conversation, the life experience of those who are wandering away from Jerusalem, wandering away from God, with the light of the faith, because as Pope Francis said, already in the reasons why they're leaving, we find the seeds of their eventual return. If we're able to identify those seeds and respond with faith, as Jesus did, they couldn't accept that the Messiah would be crucified by the invading forces that he was supposed to eliminate. But once they were able to see that this was what God had foretold would occur, that's where their hearts began to be melted. Likewise, for us, we need to enter into those experiences. And he asked very pointedly to the bishops, are we still a church that knows how to warm hearts? Again, calling the entire church to conversion, to become more on fire with our own faith, to let that fire that Jesus wanted to ignite be lit within us so that, as St. Catherine of Siena said, we can light the world ablaze. Fifth point about substance is that the church has to go out of herself, go to the peripheries. This is what got him elected, Pope Francis. 4 days before the election in the General Congregation, he gave an intervention that not only kept the time limit, which was a novelty apparently in the General Congregation, where most of the cardinals would go beyond the 5 minutes that they were asked to respect, but at the same time, he went so much more deeply and said that the church has a choice, whether it's going to remain in itself, focused on theological narcissism, ecclesiastical navel-gazing, worried so much about internal institutional concerns, or whether she was going to be an evangelizing church and go to others. And he gave a description of what the next pope ought to be, not knowing at the time that he was writing his own job description, that the next pope has to be someone who, from the contemplation of Christ, is able to go out with Christ to all those, not just on the geographical outskirts, but in the existential outskirts. People who are wounded, people who are far away, people who just don't think that Christ and his message is relevant to them. He's calling the entire church to do the same. Priests, lay people, religious, all of us. That the great danger is when we enter into our own selves. And he's, throughout the last several years, used the expression that when the church focuses mainly on internal concerns, we're sick, we're ill. The church doesn't have a mission. The church is a mission, as Paul the Sixth said. And it's only when we're living that evangelizing side of the church that we're healthy. Sixth, he's trying to bring about a culture of encounter. It's one of his most important words. With all the new movements on May 18th, he said, it's important to be ready for encounter. For me, this word is very important. Encounter with others. Why? Because faith is an encounter with Jesus, and we must do what Jesus does. We must encounter others. We live in a culture of conflict, of fragmentation, in which I throw away what's no use to me, of waste. We need to reverse that by a culture that actually takes others seriously. So there's a twofold encounter, an encounter with God that leads to the motivation for the encountering of Jesus in others, in our brothers and sisters. Seventh, he's identified the worst evil that can affect the church as the evil of spiritual worldliness. In that intervention on March 9th that changed his own personal history, the history of the church, and the history of the world, he said, when the church is self-referent without realizing it, she believes she has her own light. She ceases to be the mystery of the moon reflecting Christ's light and gives way to that very great evil, that spiritual worldliness, which according to the great 20th century theologian Cardinal Henri de Lubac, is the worst evil that can come upon the church. On that Pentecost vigil, he added, there's one problem that can afflict Christians, the spirit of the world, the worldly spirit, spiritual worldliness, that leads to self-sufficiency, that leads us to live according to the spirit of the world rather than spirit of Jesus. When we put, for example, our faith, hope, and love in money and what money can buy, that I've got a good retirement plan, that I'm going to build not a bigger grain bin, but a bigger storage facility to put all my stuff. Pope Francis is saying we need to live by another way. And he keeps coming back to identifying, diagnosing this spiritual cancer so that we can get the help we need. As part of that spiritual worldliness, another point, he talks about the ferocious idolatry of money. That the real idol to whom many are giving homage today is money. In that O Globo interview in Brazil, he said, "The world in which we're living has fallen into a ferocious idolatry of money. There's a worldwide policy dominated by the pursuit of money. What's in control now is money, and those who aren't economically productive are cast aside, especially the elderly and the very young." He said, "This is our golden calf." He's used several times an image from a medieval rabbi who talked about building the Tower of Babel. And when a brick fell, everybody was very upset. But when a human being fell down and died from Babel, nobody seemed to care. He says, this is what plagues so much of our world today. And we need to recover that poverty of spirit so that we really treasure the kingdom, especially how the king seeks to live in others. Ninth, said many times that the church can't be an NGO, a non-governmental organization. The day after he was elected pope, I had the privilege to translate this live for EWTN. He said, "We can walk as much as we want, we can build many things, but if we don't profess Jesus Christ, things go wrong. That's when we become a charitable NGO, but not the church, the bride of Christ." To the bishops in Brazil, he said, "The church is an institution. But when she makes herself a center, she becomes merely functional and slowly turns into a kind of NGO. From an institution, she becomes an enterprise. She stops being a bride and ends up becoming an administrator. From being a servant, she becomes an inspector." When the church becomes an NGO, she loses her salt. She has no savor. She's only an empty organization. Finally, to his young Argentinians in Rio, he said, "Parishes, schools, institutions are made for going out. If they don't go out, they become an NGO. And the church can't become an NGO, a non-governmental charitable organization that just serves certain material needs to the respect of many, but doesn't really bring the greatest gift of all, who is the gift of God." Tenth, he's talked about the problem of Catholics making our faith, making the whole message of the gospel, an ideology. First, I didn't know what he was talking about, but he's come back to it several times. What does he mean? We start to sever, for example, the principles and the moral teachings of our faith from its living connection with Jesus. That's what the scribes and the Pharisees would do, where they focused on the law more than they focused on the intention of the legislator with a capital L. Just even this Monday, he returned to the theme and he said, there's always that temptation so that we begin to focus so much on the teachings that we fail to find out how the Lord's constantly seeking to transform us through conversion and transform others. He talked about various forms of it: sociological reductionism, psychologizing our faith, the Gnostic solution, in which we begin to think that the faith is just secret knowledge, or the Pelagian solution, that really what's most needed is our own works rather than God's work in us through grace. 11th, he returns often to a Spanish word that expresses his own spiritual autobiography and what he believes is the way God always interacts with each of us. He calls it primeriar. It's not really translated very easily in English, but it means God always goes first. When he spoke with his fellow Jesuits on the Feast of St. Ignatius, he said, I serve Jesus because he sought me first, because I was won over by him. This is the heart of our experience. He goes for us always. In Spanish, there's an expressive word that explains it very well. Él nos primería. He precedes us. He's always first. When we arrive, he's always there waiting. And that's the essence of his vocational story. September 21st, first day of spring in the southern hemisphere, before he was going out with his friends at a train station, just wanted to go pray for a few minutes at his parish church of San Jose. That's when he saw a priest who radiated holiness that he didn't recognize. Asked to hear his confession. And inside that confessional, he recognized that God, before he had said fiat lux and created the heavens and the earth, had made an appointment to be there that day to call him. And in that experience of receiving mercy, he became a mercy maker. He recognized that he was going to be sent out. But God was there waiting for him first. And he comments that God always precedes us. 12th and last, he's been emphasizing that we are our brother's keeper. On September 7th at the Vigil for Peace, he said, "It's exactly in chaos that God asks man's conscience, 'Where is Abel, your brother?' Cain responds, 'I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?' We too are asked this question. It would be good for us to ask ourselves as well, 'Am I really my brother's keeper?' Yes, you are your brother's keeper. To be human means to care for one another. When we fail to care for someone else, we're subhuman," he's basically saying. And the most powerful way he gave this message was when he went to Lampedusa, which is where 20,000 people have perished in the short journey from North Africa to this island off the southern coast of Sicily. 20,000 have perished in the last 25 years. We've just had two more shipwrecks after the one that he had immediately gone there for. And he said there, "We have to ask that question, 'Where is your brother?' 'His blood cries out to me,' says the Lord." He said, "This is not a question directed to others, directed to me, to you, to each of us. Where is your brother? Who's responsible for his blood?" He told the story in Spanish literature of a town called Fuente Ovejuna, who killed the governor because he's a tyrant. And they did it in such a way that no one knows who the actual killer is. So the royal judge asks, "Who killed the governor?" And they all reply, "Fuente Ovejuna, Señor. Everybody and nobody." Today the question has got to be asked, "Who's responsible for the blood of these brothers and sisters?" "Nobody," is our answer. "It isn't me. I don't have anything to do with it. Must be someone else. Certainly not me." Today no one in our world feels responsible. We've lost a sense of responsibility for our brothers and sisters. We've fallen into a globalized indifference. We've become so used to the suffering of others that it doesn't affect me. It doesn't concern me. It's none of my business. I don't shed a tear. Pope Francis is calling us to a new solidarity, ultimately to a new love, to draw near. Cercanía is one of his expressions, that there's a nearness that goes together with that encounter. Because that's where the Lord is not only sending us, but where he's gone before us to meet us. There are many lessons we can take from Pope Francis's style and substance. I think over the course of his continued papacy, he's going to intensify these points and continue to exceed neat categorizations as he tries to communicate that good news that St. John tells us not all the libraries in the world can contain. Thanks very much for your attention.